May it please the court, Matthew Bergman, on behalf of the Rubley family, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
It is undisputed in this case that Vernon Rubley was exposed to an asbestos-containing product packaged in a container emblazoned with the Pfizer logo. It is undisputed that Vernon Rubley's asbestos exposure occurred in the precise manner recommended in the Pfizer-labeled instruction manual, How to Use Insulag. It is undisputed that for 10 years after Johns Manville began placing warnings on substantially similar asbestos products, the Pfizer-Quigley product not only had no warnings, but Pfizer-labeled promotional materials affirmatively lauded the product as non-injurious. Finally, it is undisputed that the side-by-side co-worker of Vernon Rubley understood and relied on the Pfizer logo to, when he observed people using an asbestos product without respiratory protection, in concluding that it was a safe product. In his words, it was made by a drug company. I had to presume that it was safe. We respectfully submit that the trial court erred in ignoring this undisputed evidence, together with unrefuted expert testimony, that in reliance upon these representations, a reasonable consumer could have concluded that the product that Vernon Rubley was exposed to and worked around was a manufactured by Pfizer.
Has any court adopted your reasonable consumer as opposed to the reasonable purchaser test?
Many courts have, Your Honor. Most importantly, the bankruptcy court in Pfizer explicitly held that the test was one of a reasonable consumer. Moreover, the Pennsylvania court in the Benny Hardy case, as well as in the Connolly versus Uniroyal case, the focus was on the reasonable consumer. Moreover, under the gravamen of Washington,
were those both apparent manufacturer cases?
They were indeed, Your Honor, yes. And moreover, on our Washington courts under the Talbert case, the focus has always been on the reasonable consumer. However, based on the record in this case, even if the court determines that the focus is on a purchaser, based upon the unrefuted expert testimony of Mr. Geisbühler, as well as documents including the technical manual that directed toward actual purchasers, even an actual purchaser could have been misled. It was improper, we submit, for the trial court to substitute its judgment for a jury in determining what a reasonable consumer would or would not perceive. Consequently, we believe that under either theory, and I want to be very clear, that the materials that we provided to the court establish that either a user of the product, when looking at how to use Insulag, I mean, who could that be directed to besides a user, would reach the conclusion that, based upon Mr. Geisbühler's testimony, that was a Pfizer product. Moreover, the technical data manual, which provides very highly technical information, specifically includes evidence that from which a sophisticated user could reach that conclusion. Mr. Geisbühler was asked to assume that the individual, a sophisticated purchaser, who saw these promotional materials, didn't see them, and didn't have the history, was asked to assume that, and Mr. Geisbühler testified that individual would assume it was a Pfizer product. In this case, the trial courts most particularly erred in ignoring the unrefuted testimony from the actual individuals who worked with and around the product, in focusing on the promotional materials exclusively. So even if, you know, besides weighing the evidence and determining what a reasonable consumer would or wouldn't conclude, the trial court was focusing on the wrong testimony. Unlike in the Stein case, where the plaintiff had no knowledge of the Pfizer product, and there was no evidence that it had any that he had any conception of what the product was, the actual plaintiff and his coworker, as well as two similarly situated coworkers, testified that they understood the product to be a Pfizer product. In contrast, in the Stein case, the unrefuted testimony was that the only co-workers in Bethlehem Steel explicitly understood that it was a Quigley product. Moreover, unlike in the Stein case, where the expert conceded that that the Insulag was a Pfizer product. We have expert testimony, and significantly, the trial court credited that testimony. The trial court admitted that testimony, and there's been no cross appeal, so that's part of this record. And the expert testified, and this was the guy who designed the NBC Peacock. This was no slouch of an expert. And this expert concluded that a reasonable consumer or a sophisticated purchaser, upon looking at these materials, would reach the conclusion that it was a Pfizer product. The apparent manufacturer doctrine rests on the idea that where a entity affixes its label to a product as a warranty or to vouch for its fitness for use, that they should be held liable for what they've held out to the public. They put it out.
I'm a little confused. You say your expert opined on purchasers. Where is that in his declaration?
It's in his deposition, Your Honor, and it was quoted in the reply brief. He was saying, I want you to assume, sir, that a purchaser of the product who went to work in 1969, who didn't have, you know, the prior history of Quigley, I would like you to assume that that individual, that sophisticated purchaser, looked at this. What would that sophisticated purchaser understand? And this individual, and Mr. Geisbühler testified that they would understand it was a Pfizer product. You know, I'd like also, if you
are
look
you
at
saying that, I mean, is your position that it really doesn't matter whether the person looking at this was actually a purchaser or not? In other words, you're saying that if a worker works with this product and sees that Pfizer is on it, then that satisfies the apparent manufacturer.
Yes, that's consistent with Washington case law. In Lockwood, this court has held that a person doesn't actually have to look at the product and read the warning to be a user. Similarly, in Lunsford, this court has held that take-home people are users of the product. So the No, they were not, Your Honor. But moreover, if you look at the Connolly case as well as the Bandamardi case, apparent manufacturers it doesn't have to be the sophisticated user. That's never been the focus of Washington law throughout the tort law. Thank you, Judge.
You have your 3 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is Sheila Birnbaum. I represent Pfizer. It's hard to unpack everything that plaintiff's counsel said, but it has nothing to do with Section 400. Because of the bankruptcy injunction order here, the only way Pfizer can be held liable is if it fits under Section 400. It's like the plaintiffs have not even read the language to the court of Section 400. It's a very specialized section for a very specialized reason. We're not here for piercing the corporate veil. We're not here for enterprise liability. Was Pfizer putting itself out as the sole manufacturer in place of the manufacturer? What is Section 400 about?
Does it have to be the sole manufacturer?
Yes, Your Honor. That's what it means. The paradigm case of a parent manufacturer is Arma puts its name on a can of corned beef. It doesn't indicate who the manufacturer is.
That's one instance, but what if Pfizer, instead of having Quigley distribute this, had Quigley marketed, labeled just as it was sold, but Pfizer sends its salesmen out, and as part of their sales program, they have a whole portfolio of products, including Quigley products and other subsidiaries' products. Does that change the analysis?
It might have been a seller of the product at that point, which we know is not the case here. They didn't manufacture it. They didn't sell it. They had nothing to do with this product. They are merely the parent of Quigley.
And where that may be true here, but you said that they have to be the sole apparent manufacturer using the Armour case, and I'm challenging that.
Well, Your Honor would look at, there is no case cited anywhere in the plaintiff's brief that shows where there are two manufacturers. The reason for the rule, Section 400, is the actual manufacturers are known, because a consumer looks at the product and the only name on the product is the name of the seller. the apparent manufacturer. So the consumer, the product user was without a remedy because they couldn't sue the manufacturer. They didn't know who the manufacturer was. Here, it is clear from the packaging who the manufacturer is. It's Quigley. It's a Quigley product. It's advertised as a Quigley product through Quigley salespeople. And you can't have a parent manufacturer. If you look at what it says, one who puts out as his own product a chattel manufactured by another. You have to put out as your product a chattel manufactured by another. Stands in the shoes of the manufacturer. Here we know who the manufacturer is. Pfizer doesn't stand in Quigley's shoes. Pfizer is a parent of Quigley. And if you look through the documents, the many, many documents here, you'll see in most of them, Quigley is identified as the subsidiary of Pfizer. It's very clear to anyone. And Quigley's been selling this product for decades to the same sophisticated users.
If a new, one of the points made by opposing counsel is if somebody was a new sophisticated buyer that came into the marketplace for this product after Pfizer had acquired it.
Well, I think if you look at his expert's deposition, it's clear from that deposition that after he's asked this hypothetical question of someone who has no knowledge whatsoever, looking at only 8 documents that they picked and gave to him, rather than the enormous amounts of documents that were in this case, he did no independent view of this, the expert. And then what does he say? A purchaser.
Is that weighing the evidence?
No. Because he says himself, the expert, that the purchaser here is a sophisticated purchaser who does his homework, who knows the product, who does know what he's dealing with because he deals with it all the time. This is an industrial product for industrial use. There is no case that they can cite that is an industrial product with industrial use where you don't look at the reasonable purchaser. 5 courts have now looked at this. 5 trial courts have looked at this. 2 federal courts in Washington. The court below looked at this. A court in Maryland. And the appellate court in Maryland and the equivalent of the Supreme Court of Maryland refused to take it. They all apply the same test, a reasonable purchaser test.
Well, what they're arguing for, as I understand it, is that it's the idea of the worker, just the ordinary consumer, just anybody really, if they looked at the label, would they think, okay, Pfizer must be the manufacturer of this product? And you're saying they can't cite any case that applies that. Can you cite a case where that particular test
yes, Your Honor, of course.
Rejected?
Yes. Hebel, that's the case. He cites the cases that have been overruled. I mean, the case he cites to the Connolly case was overruled by the Hebel case. The Hebel case is as close to this case as anyone has found. Commercial setting, they buy a car wash material, and the car wash material...
Conveyor.
What's that?
It's a conveyor.
Yeah, well, it's part of a conveyor, but it's the whole car wash material, and it has the name on it of Sherman. But the conveyor was manufactured by someone else. And the employee there who was hurt says, I saw Sherman. So Sherman is the apparent manufacturer. Court and Hebel said, no, that's not the way it works.
Why not?
Because you have to have the reasonable purchaser with knowledge of what he is buying. He's relying. You've got to look at who's relying.
Right, but the ordinary consumer, just as a sort of as a superficial impression, right? I mean, these are the people who work with it, like you say, the car wash operator. And so you would think, well, if somebody's going to put their name on this, I should be able to sue them.
Hebel says, and quite clearly, and no case is different than that, that what the casual observer sees is wholly immaterial.
And why is that? Why does the law?
Because they don't buy
law?
It. They're not relying. Remember what a parent manufacturer is about. You stand in the shoes of the real manufacturer because you don't know who the real manufacturer is. And there would be nobody to sue but the seller. Here we don't even have a seller.
The argument that they may not be the purchaser, but they might decide not to work with a particular product unless they were confident based on the name on the label. In this case, Pfizer, wonderful reputation, so it must be safe to work with.
That's so hypothetical, Your Honor, for this reason. These aren't even users of the product. They're bystanders. It doesn't matter what they say. They're just there.
Hold on a second. There's a declaration from one fellow who was a co-worker of the decedent who says that he was looking at the bag and saw Pfizer on it and thought it must be the drug company, and he worked with it.
No, that's not what he says. He was not a worker of that product. He was a bystander, and he did not work with the product. He worked
but
around
let's
the
assume
product.
That he did. Let's suppose, I mean, you're saying that even if somebody did work with a product, that wouldn't qualify them.
Not an industrial product such as this. And the only two cases the court has is the
but evil. So the idea of product liability, generally speaking, is to provide a way for people to sue the entities that are responsible for a product being in the stream of commerce, no matter how remote they are, if they had some responsibility for putting it into the stream of commerce, where it made this person sick. So why isn't this not just one other theory by which you can do that?
You could under 402A. A seller can be liable under 402A today in most jurisdictions for putting a product into the stream of commerce, for distributing the product in the same way a manufacturer would.
But so you're saying that really this is only to be used, 400, in a case where you can't figure out who the manufacturer is, but the restatement doesn't actually say that.
Well, the case law does say that, and there are cases that clearly say that, and all of the cases that you will see cited, even by the plaintiff, where you do have consumers who have bought the product, they rely on the product seller, because that was the only name they could rely on. You have to have objective reliance here. And the only people that can rely are the purchasers, because they are the ones that are interacting. And the cases here are so clear. Okay. Hebel is clear. Stein is a case that is so, it's on these facts. Same documents were presented as here. It did not matter, because the court goes through the entire
history. So the
purchaser
doesn't have to be the person who's been made ill. They just have to be the part of the test that you're...
Absolutely not. There's no question here that a bystander can recover if the product is defective. But you have to look under Section 400. And I'm talking about 402A. It's only 400.
You have to read 400 in conjunction with 402A
no.
to show that there's several different ways to recover.
No, 402A is totally different. It's a strict liability theory. Section 400 is a negligence theory. You put out the product, you stand in the shoes of the manufacturer. And if you look at comment D, and I think this is really telling, because
counsel, wind up your comments, please.
I will, Your Honor. If you look at comment D, it says we're the real manufacturer is clearly and accurately identified on the label or other markings of the goods. It's clearly stated that another is named, that they distributed. Then there's no apparent manufacturer. You have to look at comment D of Section 400. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Nancy.
Well, I'd like to follow up on comment D because it specifically references the situation we have here where there are more than one entities that are identified. Comment D states, the mere fact that the goods are marketed with such additional words as made for the seller or describe him as a distributor, particularly in the absence of a clear and distinctive designation of the real manufacturer packer, is not sufficient to make applicable the rule stated in this section.
What do you do with the additional licensor who does not sell or otherwise distribute products is not liable under this section of the state?
That you're talking about in Section 1? Section A?
Comment D.
First of all, the record in this case specifically establishes an extensive evidence that they were within the chain of distribution. That's extensively set forth in our briefs, down from every avenue of marketing the product, from purchasing the raw asbestos to hiring the salespeople.
So does your theory then require us to agree with you that there's at least an issue of fact as to whether Pfizer was in the chain of distribution?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe the trial court got it right on this respect. Responding to the question, there have been numerous courts in the Bandy Marty case. That was not a purchaser. That was a worker who was exposed to an industrial product, and it was the precise subsidiary relationship that you have here. In Connolly versus Uniroyal, again, the individual was not the purchaser of the product.
The counsel tells us Connolly's been overruled.
Connolly has been distinguished by Hebel. The Hebel case in particular, Your Honor, the injurious product was not the product that was not, it was a large component piece of equipment with multiple pieces of equipment as part of the car wash system, and the injurious product was not the product that caused the injury. In this case, it's undisputed that it was the Insulag product that was emblazoned with the Pfizer logo that caused the injury.
Is Connolly good law, or did the case
Connolly is good law. It was distinguished by Hebel on its facts. Similarly, in Davis versus Gage, the individual was injured by a welding equipment that was purchased. In all of these cases, those were line workers. Those were factory shop workers, just like Mr. Rubley and his coworkers. You cannot, you know, the fact that Pfizer and Quigley were both identified in some portion, they may win at trial. The jury might ultimately conclude that a reasonable juror could not be misled. But based on the record in this case, based on the expert testimony that was admitted without objection, it was improper for the court to substitute its judgment for the jury's on what a reasonable consumer, be it a sophisticated user or a line worker, would conclude.
Thank you, Counselor.